Welcome to Les Bouches, Les Bebes.
Well, hello, hello.
It's been a while, girl. How you doing?
I'm good. I mean, yeah. Good. What have you been up to?
Just chilling. I ate some steak earlier. Feeling a little bloated from it, but it's good.
Hey, self-acceptance.
Yeah, radical self-acceptance, you know? That's what it's all about. Do you know what song stuck in my head?
What?
It's my favorite song of all time. Tearing me apart. Okay, she doesn't know it.
I feel like
my best friend doesn't know my favorite song.
We don't share a lot of music tastes or songs to get. Like, we don't even send each other shit. We don't do a lot of the music stuff, which is kind of weird. Yeah. Maybe we should work on that.
We need to have
more continuity.
Spotify does that, like, blend.
Yes, I love that idea. Let's add it to the to-dos.
Yeah, no, we need to make a blend. And maybe we can, like, post that on our website.
Love that.
And it's going to be, like, chill rock music and then, like, like Rufus Du Sol or something.
Yes.
It'll be great.
What song stuck in my head? You
know. I don't know.
It's really random, and I don't know why this came to my head, and I don't know why it got here, because I haven't listened to it a long time, but it was, I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton Eye Joe.
Did you know that that song, I don't mean to be a downer on this, has... like racial references
I
in it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
I feel like...
Well, it is sad. It's not kind of sad. It's fucked up.
What's the storyline?
I'm going to have to do more research on this, but I'm pretty sure that it's linked, like Cotton Eye Joe is linked to like a slave.
No.
And referencing a slave. You'd be surprised how much shit in this world is referencing slavery. It's
honestly
really
cut
fucked
from
up.
My mind. We can't support Cotton Eye Joe. I'm sorry.
No, but it's okay. I mean, it is a classic.
It was a figure skating song. That's how I know it.
Really?
Everyone skated to I Feel back in the day.
The amount of appropriation in figure skating.
It's crazy.
Unreal.
Unreal.
What about Irish, though? Because I did an Irish-themed program. And that is appropriating Irish culture, but they're white. What do you guys think? Yes? No? I don't know.
It's like the same concept, I think. It's not like... are white people. It's not been the reverse historically.
True. But there is a history in time with like Italian culture and Irish culture, specifically on the East Coast. They were, and Jewish people were deemed as like the lesser, quote unquote, lesser white people, which is fucked up in its own sense. But I just think it's a reflection on like our Anglo-Saxon Puritan America. I just threw in a lot of words describing white people. I don't know if that was right, but sounded right to me. All right, should we do hot takes?
Let's do it. So this is a game that Rachel, did you make this up? Did you create this game? Are you the creator, founder, CEO of Hot Takes?
I'm not going to claim that because like I genuinely don't even remember where it came from. And it also
unknown.
Has been popping up very commonly on social media right now. But it is my go-to great way to get to know people, especially new people. And it's just like a fun game to play.
Your hot takes, you just say a hot take on life.
My hot take is like, I would describe it, I guess not like controversial, but I guess surprising if you have followed me for a bit or if you know my background. But I feel like the influencer industry as we know it is unsustainable for a lot of reasons.
I don't even know if that could count fully as a hot take because I think everyone agrees with you.
But not in my industry.
But like,
definitely.
What do you mean by sustainable? Because I know from like being friends with you for so long and see all the PR packages you get, some brands will send you every single shade of foundation.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're going to use one, maybe two, but they send you all of them. And that's so wasteful.
Brands have definitely gone down a route to try to be more sustainable from an ecological standpoint. I'm actually talking about as the industry as a whole. I genuinely do not think that this influencer industry will be around for the next 100 years. Like, I don't think it's an industry that will last. And I think there will always be online public figures and people with a presence, people with a platform, people that can facilitate this online community.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the influencer as we know it will be around, like when our kids have kids, basically. I think it will morph into something else, but I don't know what that is.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that is a hot take. That makes sense. It really is at this point just attention grabbing, yes. I think, to a certain level.
And people are going to get bored. I think people are already getting bored with it. I mean, me as a creator, I'm having trouble evaluating where I want to go with it because of that reason. On top of that, the mental health aspects of being inside the industry. Anyways, we can move on from hot takes because this is not what this episode is about. But yeah, that's mine.
You have a lot of drinks over here I want to comment on. I don't know if it's in the frame, but this liquid. Girl, this girl, she has a hydration one. She has a gut liquid one. Death. And she has a fun one. She's going around. I mean, we are definitely Team Liquid Death. So now we're getting into the history of underarm shaving, everyone. Are you excited?
I am so excited. I actually secretly, probably shouldn't be telling you this, but I secretly did my own research kind of on this. Just a little bit. I'm sorry.
Over here, over here. The type
but
A.
It's so interesting. But I'm really excited to hear what you researched and about the history.
Yeah, it was a lot to read about. With each of these topics that I feel like we're covering, I go in and I read one article, and from that one, like, published paper or article, I start getting deeper and deeper. And then I have to zoom out and be like, wait, what am I searching? Like, what is the story I'm trying to tell again? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't even remember. And so it's been a really great learning experience, obviously, for me to become a more efficient researcher. But the history of shaving actually started back in as early as the Stone Age. Back then, it was a way to keep your body clean using flint, seashells, or beeswax as utensils to scrape it off your skin and your face, like facial hair. People didn't want facial hair in the Stone Age. In order to keep their body clean and prevent from parasites. Also, to even, there are some theories about keeping your body warmer during that time, because if it got wet in the winter and you had wet hair on you, you know, that makes you colder.
Oh.
That was an interesting time. And then in ancient Rome, it shifted to smooth skin being associated with purity and superiority. Both genders, men and women, shaved most of their body. And in ancient Egypt, they had lice. So they shaved everything, Brazilian to the max, baby. And they would use these wigs called the Nubian wigs, which imitated hair on their head, was easier to clean and prevent lice from. So they would use that as a replacement for hair on their head. In order to get rid of all the hair on their whole body, they would use this, I'm definitely going to mispronounce this, but depilatory paste?
Yes.
Used, consisted of a mixture of lime, water, wood ash, and arsenic trisulfide.
Okay, I've heard about a modern version of this, but that's very interesting that they actually called it that, like, way back then.
They didn't call it that back then.
Oh. No. You said that.
They use that type of paste.
They created it.
I don't speak Egyptian. Like, I literally... I don't know what they called it. I don't even think they know what they called it, you know?
True.
I guess we can look that up after and, like, add some footnotes.
Bonus.
Yeah. Bonus video. Patreon.
Should we start a Patreon?
Yeah, join our Patreon for us to do all of the follow-up research on some of this stuff. Yeah, so it was so interesting that all genders in ancient Egypt used to shave fucking everything just because lice was a thing.
So when did that change?
I'll get to it.
Okay.
Okay. This is astounding to me that lice has still prevailed the test of time. True. And that it still exists today. Like, come on. We've gone to space. We can't get rid of lice. Like, what is this? We're jumping to the medieval times now. So back then, only facial hair was actually considered ugly and not on trend.
For both men and women?
Yeah. And so in the 14th century, women would also pick the hair off their foreheads to make their foreheads larger and to elongate their face. And in the mid-16th century, Queen Elizabeth I came to power and she made eyebrow removal fashionable. So they didn't even have eyebrows. Like, she was almost matching us a little bit.
Queen!
And then in the 18th century, this is finally when, like, newer age shaving devices were launched, and the straight razor was invented by Sheffield in 1680. And for 200 years, this was kind of the staple of shaving, and it was mainly used for men on their facial hair. And this was one of those straight razors that, you know, you'd go to a barber and they do you up and do the whole situation. And so this was kind of male focused when it came to shaving. And I think women still were expected not to have facial hair at this time, but obviously it's not as common for women to have facial hair in the first place. I didn't really find a lot of documentation about that. But another thing to call out as I continue on and the story keeps developing is that in the Victorian era around this time, femininity was based on moral character. It was about, are you going to grow up, find a nice husband, be a good mother, be a good like household manager, and that was the epitome of hotness and what femininity was.
Right.
So now let's shift to the 19th and 20th century, where there was then a cultural shift in the 1920s, where the feminine idea of beauty was based on the body. It wasn't based on what moral character people did. It was body conscious. You know, clothes were starting to become more revealing.
Right.
So it was the other thing, like, it didn't really matter what your body looked like back in that day because you were hiding a lot of your body under all these huge garments. So now, in the early 1900s is when it does become a bit more body focused. And I think that's going to be such an interesting topic for us to dive into on our later episodes because now it's like, all about body.
Yeah,
you know,
body, yaddy, yaddy.
A lot of this is related to Darwin's theory of natural selection, actually, where he mentioned in his book, The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, he literally, quote, said, primitive ancestry and an atavistic return to earlier, less developed forms as a way to describe body hair. So he was anti-Bush. He was ripping apart the body hair movement.
Not fully accepting.
Yeah. And so by the early 20th century, upper and middle class in white America was very focused on having smooth skin as a marker of femininity, and female body hair was considered repulsive back then.
It's insane how it changed so many times, like throughout history, of the direction of like what this thing meant to society and culture.
Yeah. And it's interesting how for such a long ass time, it wasn't gendered body hair.
Right.
You know? And now we're in a state where it is very much gendered in society today. So it's just interesting reading about how for hundreds, thousands of years, maybe if it was taboo to have body hair, it was taboo for both genders. Like, it wasn't just women. Versus today.
Which I do think in history, there's a bit of a tendency over decades and centuries to feel this like pendulum swing back and forth of like what things are considered appropriate or whatever in regards to gender, in regards to really anything in life, this cadence of going back and forth. So maybe we're swinging back to a time where it is a more all gender situation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I do feel like we're moving that direction. We're not there yet, but we're moving in that direction.
Yeah. It's just really hard to unlearn some of these things.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely.
I've grown out like my armpit hair a couple of times just out of like pure laziness of shaving. Then I'll see a picture of myself being like, woo, with my arms up. And I'm like, ugh, like, why didn't I just shave? But that's an unlearning that we have to work on, because it really is defined by social norms and it's not defined by anything other than that. It's not a gut reaction that we were born with. It was something that we learned as we grew up.
Right, exactly. And you are entitled to feel and do whatever you choose for your body. And that's the thing that I think I'm trying to relearn as I unlearn all the negative connotations.
For sure. In the early 1900s, there were three main drivers, and I kind of mentioned this earlier, that fed into the reason why underarm shaving became so common with women. And the first one was hair removal products in the industry that were male focused realized that there was a huge market to target women for some of these same products. The other thing was women's clothing fashion. And the third one is invention of the printer press, so mass production of women's magazines. In 1903, the first men's disposable safety razor was introduced, and it became really popular because prior to that, the straight razor was mainly for you go to a barber, they do it for you, maybe go once a week. So you grow stubble back and then you go. But then once a straight razor was introduced, it was a way to prove that you could be upper class because you were clean shaven every day. And it was almost the same as the upper class people who were going to the barber every day and having a barber shave them. So it became common to prove that you were rich, essentially.
Almost like a physical representation of your worth.
And wealth. Yeah, those were like the three main drivers. And then in the early 1900s was the Great Underarm Campaign. They've literally called it this, which is so interesting. And so in 1908, there were advertisements suggesting women remove their underarm hair and explaining like how and why to do it. There was an estimated advertising spending between 1890 and 1914 that grew from $190 million to $682 million.
What?
Insane. It's like a 3x, over 3x, tripling on toiletries and beauty specifically. So in 1915, Harper's Bazaar launched their first campaign devoted to the removal of underarm hair, and they called it a necessity. And Gillette launched their, I'm gonna mispronounce this, Milady Décolleté. Actually, I think that was good. And it was, Gillette was known as a men's shaving company, and this was their first female-focused razor. And it was advertised in Harper's Bazaar and all the female print magazines. They used words smoothing instead of shaving, and limbs instead of legs.
To appeal to the feminine mind.
And make it more palatable, essentially.
Right.
And hair was described as unwelcome, embarrassing, unsightly, and unclean. No one wants to be unclean. So, of course, all the ladies are swarming the stores to buy this Milady Décolleté. Another thing, too, we talked about the change of women's fashion. So, shorter hemlines in the 1930s and 40s, people were showing their legs. When people were showing their legs, women usually wore stockings.
Right.
But in World War II, there was a shortage of nylon. They showed bare legs. Because stockings were expensive to wear, buy and wear. People felt like they needed to shave. And that contributed as well. And then in 1946, the bikini was introduced. Once the bikini was introduced with no hair in ads, it kind of influenced women to say, oh shit, I got a little bush down there, gotta get rid of it. And then in 1953, Playboy launched and had clean shaven vaheens on there. What are we gonna refer to? What are we gonna refer to vaginas to? And I guess we can just call them for what they are. They are vaginas.
Yeah.
What are the other terms for them? I'm like pussy? Blanking. If you have any recommendations on how we should reference a vagina, Joe. What?
Punani.
Punani. That's a good one. That's a good one. All right. So where was I? Oh, yeah. Playboy. Gotta love to hate Hugh Hefner. The 60s, 98% of American women aged 15 through 44 were regularly shaving their legs.
98%?
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's like in school when they're like, you're in the 98 percentile and your parents throw you apart. Like, you're like, oh my God, extra cereal tomorrow. I'm just kidding.
No, seriously, it is crazy. And then the 70s and 80s, there was a resurgence, obviously, mm-hmm. of the bush mm-hmm. and feminists mm-hmm. and people were explicitly rejecting that. But then in 1987, a group of seven sisters named the J Sisters from Brazil opened a salon in, where are we now? New York City, baby.
New York, New York.
And they offered the so-called Brazilian.
Ooh, the Brazilian has entered the chat.
When they rip out all the butthole hairs too. Not just the bush, the back bush as well.
I like got a tinge of pain as you said that from like PTSD.
So that is when it all started, was 87. And so it kind of is to all that led up to what has influenced us today, which is an estimated 80 to 99% of American women today remove hair from their bodies, except Korea. Korea pubic hair was long considered a sign of fertility and sexual health. As late as the mid-2010s, women in Korea were undergoing pubic hair transplants to add hair to their bush, which is so interesting. Wow,
I haven't heard of that. Is this a it's not popular in the U.S. amongst the Korean community, is it? I'm not sure.
But we got to look
look it up.
In 2008, there was a professor, Professor Foz, talked about this idea of like heterosexism and homophobia linked to shaving. And it shouldn't be that like revolutionary to decide to shave or not to shave. But somehow it's like we're talking about hair. ingrained in our society that it is.
Like why it like honestly I have that thought has come across my mind, like the fact that like this does play such a huge role in the way people look at genders and sexual preferences is actually insane when you think about it.
It's fucking crazy.
It's insane.
And then I thought this was a fun roundabout tidbit, is that in 2019 the same magazine that launched that first iconic shaving ad in 2019, Harper's Bazaar September issue, launched cover shoot with Emily Ratajkowski, and she had fully hairy armpits, and so it was a full roundabout circle that it was Harper's Bazaar promoting shaving, and now they're promoting not shaving, I guess. And there have been, obviously, as we all know, like a bunch of other like pop culture depictions of no shaving, so it is kind of coming back. I still see it personally as a bit taboo to grow out your arm hair, but it is more common now. But I do somewhat sometimes see it as like, oh, you, or make assumptions about people if they don't shave. That's my own thing that I should probably unlearn and work on.
I do believe that you are entitled to your own choice about your body, but I just think it's interesting for me because I, in my own life, have really like gone back and forth with this. And I feel like I'm at a place now where like, I am embracing my body hair a little bit more. Like, I've stopped getting laser. I don't know where this journey, if you want to call it that or whatever, will lead me. But, like, yeah, it's kind of an interesting experience. Because it does tie into my self-worth, I think, internally. Like, not intentionally, internally.
You can do whatever you want to do. But just the fact that, I guess, when we were younger growing up, it was so common and it was almost expected for us to go through a painful experience to feel like you fit in and would be sexy is such a fucked up thing that like happens to most cis women when they are growing up. And my
grow
final
heart bush if you really want.
My final ad is just from the beginning of time when these companies started advertising razors to women, these women were already hairless, shaving something that wasn't there, like this. They were literally shaving this, and it was like, okay, like, and showing even a woman with hair on a TV screen or in a magazine was taboo to begin with. So they were just showing people shaving clean skin. And so there are other companies like Billy, who is women-focused razor company that started in 2017, just being realistic about it. Like, we're going to sell you razors, but we're also going to show you a girl with a hairy leg shaving the hair off her leg. You know, we don't have to show you a bare skin and, like, pretend like she's shaving something when nothing's even there, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting final tidbit.
Honestly, very interesting, and I feel like very ups and downs through history.
Ups and downs, ups and downs. The Nubian wig, I definitely want some point. I think a life goal is to either see one in person. If I could try one on, that'd be amazing, but let's be realistic here. I doubt I'll ever get to put on an ancient Egyptian artifact, but it would be dope. Question bank.
I feel like I don't have questions because you really went in detail about like every aspect of that. Like, I feel like I just took a full course on shaving.
Thanks.
But I also didn't go to college, so I have nothing to compare this to the course load, I mean. History of engagement rings. Let's do this.
Ow, ow.
Oh, woo, woo. Honestly, this is a lot less intricately woven, I think, than the history of shaving, but it kind of does tie in with the marketing, which I think is interesting.
History is a little condensed.
It's condensed because there was a monopoly. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun.
A corrupt monopoly. Okay. Well, a lot of people misrepresent engagement rings with having their early beginnings in ancient Rome, but from what I have read, ancient Egyptians were actually the first known people to use a ring to signify the commitment, to like actually feel like the circular shape of a ring signified this means commitment because this is eternal. There is no ending. There is no beginning. It is a circular thing that we wear on our fingers for the rest of our lives, which I thought was like very interesting. And the reason why we wear our engagement rings, generally speaking, on our fourth finger is because the fourth finger, I guess, has a vein that goes directly to the heart.
Oh. And,
yeah.
Wow.
So that was another form of symbolism.
So only out of all five of our fingers, only the fourth?
That's what, from what I read, that was what the Egyptians believed. Maybe that's not, maybe that's what they believed. And that's why they were like, it goes to the heart. Let's put it on that ring.
I'm surprised they weren't like middle finger, like,
you know? For everyone not watching the video, she flipped us off. I love it. Love me a little rebel. But yeah, over time, again, similar to shaving, it seems like engagement rings endured some ups and downs just throughout history and also based on economic standing, because obviously a ring is not a necessity. And from what I've read, honestly, it seems like most of the time society didn't view them as necessities. There's only been a couple eras where they're actually thought of as necessary to symbolize your love. Literally, prior to World War II, less than 10% of Americans had engagement rings.
Yeah, my dad said that his mom didn't have an engagement ring.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't very common back then, and that's why he doesn't wear an engagement ring, because it just wasn't part of his family culture, I guess.
Yeah. So fast forward to the 1930s, enter the De Beer family. This is the monopolizers. And they had a very tactical marketing strategy, because essentially what they did was they created a monopoly over the diamond mining industry and then created this fantasy around it that they could use in their marketing strategies to convince people that the engagement ring or diamonds specifically represented forever, represented love, represented marriage. Like, if you got married and you don't have a diamond, you're not worthy. Like, that's not a worthy man. They really played off this like real men buy diamonds thing, which is like
toxic masculinity, man.
Seriously. Their marketing strategy started off kind of subtly tying in their diamonds on actresses, on the red carpet, on models. So literally when I was reading this, I was like, okay, so kind of like the current influencer. It's like a subtle way to make it seem relatable, to make it seem like, oh, your favorite girl, she's wearing diamonds. You need diamonds. You need diamonds to feel beautiful. You need diamonds to like
a fantasy thing.
Exactly. Once they started to make diamonds themselves seem more accessible and admirable by, you know, seeing them viewed in your on your favorite celebrities, they actually started creating these marketing campaigns, which was kind of the thing that really took them to the next level, because now over a really slow rollout of not only monopolizing the industry and owning all of the industry from the inside, then subsequently creating this fantasy around it, then they launched these marketing campaigns. So one of the most popular was Diamonds Are Forever, which basically aimed to convince the average American that their life and marriage would literally not be complete without it, and that diamonds are the thing that makes it an eternal thing, like not the love itself. The diamond. So Diamonds Are Forever was such a huge success. Mm-hmm. I think it raised, I deleted the percentage from my notes. I'm sorry, guys. This is my first research project. I'm really sorry. I promise I'll get better at this.
No, but I don't think worry it was
like,
at all.
Like a big percentage. Okay, we'll include that in the bonus episode.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But another one they used is only 1 month's salary. So now that they've conceptualized this idea of the engagement ring as being this forever thing, they started to rework the way that they were putting the wording out. so that yeah. now men thought, okay, it lasts forever. Not only that, it represents love and marriage and all of eternity, and it's only 1 month's salary. When prior to this time, like, no one would have thought to spend literally thousands of dollars on a diamond ring.
Like for why would you?
It's unless you had the means. Like, not the yeah. average person felt that that was a necessity. Following the Great Depression, there was a stark crash of the engagement ring because modest times called for obviously more modest measures, and it all of a sudden became more of not a necessity because yeah. they literally could not make it a necessity anymore. Mm-hmm. So we were going into this time where people were using actually more modest stones, not diamond rings. So the engagement rings still existed. They were just not typically made of diamonds following the Great Depression. They were being made of rubies, of emeralds, of sapphires, like all these other stones that had a little bit more of a reachable price range for that time. So what did the De Beers do? They were like, oh no, I cannot lose this. We gotta like keep this afloat. We gotta ring these people out for all that they're worth and get them yeah. back on diamonds, basically. They actually raised their sales 55% within 3 years by going through these marketing strategies. So the diamonds are forever, the mm-hmm. 1 month salary, which then later turned into 2 months when they saw it started working, they raised their prices by double. And then they started marketing it as only 2 months salary, but that 2 month salary can last forever. So yeah. why would you not do that? If you actually love this person,
yeah.
you would do 2 months for forever.
And De Beers isn't American, right?
No, they are. They are.
Really?
Yeah, they literally own the entire American diamond market.
I thought they were based internationally because America has anti-monopoly laws in place to prevent shit like this. So I was just wondering.
See, look, yeah, New York City, it started. Madison Ave.
Damn, it's crazy how it all started here. I forget that when I live here that it truly is the capital of so much history in America. I've always thought that, like, going on a historical, like, walking tour of New York would be cringe, but I feel like I really should at some point just to, you know, like, walk around and see, oh shit, that building is where, like, Hamilton was based off of or something. That is the dumbest point of history that I care about. Like, not even Alexander Hamilton, the play, the Hamilton, but, like, it's just crazy how it all started. Even the Brazilian wax. As yeah. we just talked about.
Okay, so once, like I mentioned, they were trying to stay afloat. They were trying to get some new marketing strategies going, and they had only, similar to shaving and Gillette and everything you were talking about, they had only really marketed towards men so that they could buy for their female counterparts. But they actually tried to launch a male engagement ring, and it didn't go well. Like, it did not work. The marketing strategies, like, completely failed because women at that time, even in the 1970s, after women were in this very feminist movement, they did not have the means because their salaries were, I think, over 40% lower than what an average man would make. So if they had the means to spend a little extra on a diamond, they were still going to buy it to themselves because of this history that the De Beers themselves actually created with this, like, gender-based engagement, diamonds, men, yeah, real, yeah. blah, 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 blah.
It really is crazy that men didn't respond to the marketing campaign as much as women did. I don't know what that says about marketing tactics or society or about the emotional intelligence of women, maybe, and their greater need to feel like they're fitting in. I don't know. And maybe that's something we can dive deeper into another episode.
Do you think it has something to do with confidence? Which, like, I know is, I don't yeah. know. I think
maybe. And I'm not sure. Like, well, I think
yeah.
that's something that is a great thing for us to take note of to dive in deeper on our future episodes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if De Beers also has some ownership over creating this idea of, like, a proposal. And we didn't really even talk about that in this episode, but, like, that wasn't even part of our plan. But, like, maybe that's something we can do on, like, an extra for this episode or something, is look into, like, who decided all these, like, grand gesture proposals, and that the man yeah. would propose to the woman and stuff, or if that was part of the De Beers marketing campaign. Because I know we were talking about, it was like 1 month salary and then increased to 3 months and, like, all of this shit, but that was just for buying the ring. What about all this shit now where it's like this elaborate event in front of all these people.
That's true.
And then you fly the families out to celebrate after, like, who came up with that shit?
I was literally just talking to Joe about this because I was like, honestly, like, what is the point of an engagement party? Like, you're already spending so much on a wedding. So the engagement party feels like a precursor. And then, but it's like, who created that? Who created that, like, order?
I'd be interested to learn more about that. We should definitely dive into that in, like, a future thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is super cool.
Did I do okay?
You did amazingly. You were so
good.
Guys,
I'm sweating. This is my first research project in 10 years, I think.
No, you did so well, honestly.
Thanks.
You were good.
No, you were amazing. You were iconic as hell. Just before we ended out, I just wanted to, like, during my research, I found this really amazing article by Yasmin Gattas. I hope I pronounced that correctly. If I didn't, I'm so sorry. But it's basically a gender studies-based article on why De Beers couldn't sell diamonds to men. So I thought it was
That's exactly what we were talking about.
It was a super interesting read. So if you're interested in this topic, like, definitely check it out. I'll link it down below and you can find some more info on that. Oh yeah, I included some of the ads. Like, this was the one that was like the 2 month salary showed the future Mrs. Smith what the future will be like. Like, literally they were selling not only the ring, but the idea.
The woman, the who.
Like, it was worth. It was all based on, like,
that's crazy.
If this woman was worthy and if the man was worthy enough to, like, buy her a bigger diamond ring because bigger equals better. And, like,
that's like some dowry shit. That's fucked up.
And then this is the one that for the men. So this was during the time of, like, more so the 1970s.
I have to say, he's hot in it. He's pretty hot.
We love this man. I'm just kidding. But this was during a time they were actually trying. So this ad says, she has a mind of her own. She gave me a diamond. So it's basically speaking from the man's perspective. And it's like trying to empower women. But isn't that crazy to look at?
Yeah.
Like, that's how they tried to spin it. But these women didn't catch on for whatever reason. I am very grateful for marketing and the influencer world for where I am today. And I think there's a good side to marketing if you use it for the right ways. But I think the thing is with the De Beers, it felt like their intention was ill will. Their intention was to make money, which is a lot of how a lot of corporations run, obviously. And their intention was not actually to empower through this ad. Their intention was just to sell to a new audience. So they tried to manipulate or, you know, create this facade and, like, whatever, and it didn't work because it was a lie.
But yeah, unfortunately, that is the contract that public companies make when they IPO, is that they are committing to making every decision for the benefit of their shareholders and the owners. That's kind of like the backbone of capitalism. And if you want to dive deeper into that, and, like, if capitalism is the right choice for society and for the greater good of, like, the mental health and the sustainability, essentially, of our society, that's going to be a whole deeper conversation that maybe in another episode we can talk about more.
All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning
in. That was such a great story. I love that. So educational.
Thanks,
great job.
You rocked it. You killed it.
You killed it,
bitch. We love.
It was great talking to you, Rox.
I know. Good chat.
So great. Bye, Lily. Say bye to everyone.
Bye, Lily.
Lily. Lily's a
Lily's
good girl.
Our mascot, kind of, right?
Lily's the best girl.
She honestly is. Like, everyone loves Lily.
Yeah,
truly.
She's been a chiller these days.
She's the best.
She's great. Thanks for tuning into Bush Babies, guys. We support and love all the little babies.
And we'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye, Rox.
Bye, Rachel. Thank you so much for watching. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Bush Babies World, as well as our personal accounts at Roxetarisa and at Rachel Traw. And make sure to join our Discord to be an official part of the BB community. Make sure to stay up to date with everything we have going on at www.bushbabiesworld.com.